Meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:04 p.m. on Thursday, April 17th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Representative Keto, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Vice Chair Zelkowski, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Sponholz Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't already done that. Thank you. Before we get started, I want to thank Butch Carber, the House Health Secretary from Records, Madison Trubb from the Juneau LIO, and Ted Madsen, Committee Aide, for staffing the committee today. Today we'll be continuing our hearing on SB 198. We'll be listening to testimony, including public testimony, considering amendments, and then holding the bill over. First up, I'd like to invite Heather Carpenter, staff to the bill sponsor, to come forward, put yourself on the record, and just recap the legislation for us.
That's exactly what my boss said. Chair Sponholz, members of the committee, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 198 again. For the record, my name is Heather Carpenter, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. I'll just recap a little bit of information which I think is important for the committee to consider, which is how Senator Kelly got to this point of introducing this piece of legislation specifically. So Senate Bill 198 is part of our ongoing effort to eradicate fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD, that his group that he calls the Empowering Hope Group has put together, and that is the work we focus on. In your packet, one of our support letters is from the Governor's Council on Special Education and Disabilities, and they included a white paper. So from that white paper, they mentioned that FASDs are a range of developmental disabilities caused by consuming alcohol during pregnancy. The most well-known type of FASD is specifically fetal alcohol syndrome. That's the most severe kind of FAS. Alaska has the highest reported prevalence of FAS in the United States. A newly published study found that FASDs may be as common as autism, which would affect up to one in 20 children. The effects of FAS and FASDs may be physical. You've heard folks talk about in the past how it could be a flattening on your lip. They include mental disabilities, behavioral health disabilities, learning disabilities, basically things that are lifelong and continue to stay with the individual. Prenatal alcohol exposure damage is dose-related, so how much alcohol is in the bloodstream? When during the pregnancy is the alcohol in the bloodstream, or for how long is the alcohol in the fetus? Depending on when exposure happens during pregnancy, you'll see different impacts on the individual. So it could be different organ impacts depending on when they're in development, impacts to the brain, multiple things. Also from the white paper from the Governor's Council, they highlight that neonatal abstinence syndrome is caused by taking opioids during pregnancy. After birth, babies with NAS may go through drug withdrawal. Over 69% of mothers who had a baby that was diagnosed with NAS had previously given birth to other children. Infants who are exposed to opioids and alcohol during pregnancy have an increased risk for preterm birth, lifelong disabilities, and neurodevelopmental delays, with significant emotional, social, and other economic costs for both the individuals and the families. The good news is that we know that NAS and FASD are 100% preventable. There are things we can do to impact those numbers. So in 2014, Senator Kelly introduced his first piece of legislation addressing FASD, and that was Senate Concurrent Resolution 13. It was actually heard in this very room, and I testified on that resolution in April of 2014. Representative Tarr, you may remember part of that conversation. And I just wanted to highlight some of the whereas clauses that were in that resolution. So it says, whereas fetal alcohol spectrum disorder permanently alters a child's cognitive abilities, whereas fetal alcohol spectrum disorder has been identified as a pervasive and chronic driver of numerous social challenges throughout the state, and whereas the occurrence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is in the state is preventable, whereas Alaska has the highest documented prevalence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in the United States, whereas in 2012, the legislature passed legislation making the existence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder a mitigating factor for criminal sentencing. Many of you are probably familiar with Judge Michael Jeffries from Barrow, I won't try to say its new name because I'll mess it up, and he really pushed to get that legislation to happen. Whereas misconceptions continue to exist regarding the causal factors and lifelong effects of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. When we were presenting this resolution in 2014, we actually heard that many women were told by their doctor it was okay to consume alcohol during pregnancy, when we in fact know that no known amount of alcohol is safe to consume during pregnancy. And finally, one of the further resolves from this resolution was that the Alaska State Legislature supports programs that will minimize the risk of fetal alcohol exposure. So we took that pretty seriously, and we worked on several efforts to try to impact the rate of FASD in the state. That was where we intersected with Dr. Nancy Poole's four-part FASD prevention model that's being implemented around the world. Those four things include universal messaging strategies promoting FASD prevention. You may remember some of the efforts that we partnered with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority on some messaging that went out. Two is increasing access to pregnancy tests. The theory there is that if a woman knows she is pregnant sooner, she will stop drinking and exposing her baby to alcohol. Number three is increasing access to long-acting reversible contraception, or LARC. That's where this bill specifically intersects. And number four, increasing access to substance abuse treatment and support services. So in recap, specifically, through Senate Bill 198, the UAA Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies will evaluate the feasibility and effectiveness of providing long-acting reversible contraception to women involved in services such as Alaska Regional's Neonatal Abstinence Evaluation Support Treatment, or their NAS program. The population of women served by this program represent one of our highest risk groups in Alaska for unintended pregnancy and prenatal drug and alcohol exposure. The study would be done in collaboration with hospitals and healthcare providers in Alaska who treat women with substance abuse disorders. So why does this matter? Well, in Alaska, the incidence of children born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS, has increased over 500,000 from 2004 to 2015, due in part to our current opioid crisis. Alaska has more than 120 children or individuals diagnosed with FASD each year. But that true rate is probably significantly higher, according to recent national prevalence studies. 2,660 children have been diagnosed with FASD through the state of Alaska's FASD diagnostic clinic since 2001.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that number?
Mm-hmm. 2,660 children have been diagnosed with FASD since 2001 through our diagnostic clinics. Approximately 50% of infants with NAS treated at Alaska Regional Hospital's NEST program were immediately placed into the care of the Office of Children's Services. And if you remember from testimony on Tuesday, Jeff Jesse specifically said that that is a state law, that if at the hospital they see a baby has any drugs or drug exposure in their system, they immediately have to call OCS.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, back to your diagnoses of FASD. Is FASD or FASD also? Is it both?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I believe it would be both because it is the full spectrum.
And through the chair, one of the issues with both FAS and FASD is the lack of diagnosed children. So these are just ones who have come through some system where there is some diagnosis, right?
Yeah. And through the chair, Representative Johnston, you are correct. To get a diagnosis, you have to be able to prove that there was some prenatal alcohol exposure. And as you know, some women just are not going to admit that. That's just part of this challenge. Or you may have a number of these children who could end up in OCS care or adopted. Getting a diagnosis is a pretty long and lengthy process for some individuals, especially if you don't have as many symptoms or disabilities, if they're hidden disabilities, if they're learning disabilities. Not everybody has physical features that are going to show with this disorder.
Thank you.
You have two letters of support that came in today that are in your packet. One is from former Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services and who was an associate VP at the University of Alaska. That is from Karen Perdue. She specifically talks about why she supports this effort. The other one is from retired Fairbanks Superior Court Judge Nisa Steinkruger, and I just really recommend that members read that, and I just wanted to put that on the record for the public as well, that they could access those. And I just want to end that this is extremely personal to me, too. I feel pretty blessed to work for Senator Kelly and able to carry legislation like this. Before I came to work for Senator Kelly, I worked with young people that experienced FASD. I was a direct service provider. And they were specifically young people, so anybody who was under 25 is the population I was working with. Most of them had FASD. They had learning disabilities, but they had goals, they had desires. So my job was to get them jobs, help them figure out how they work around every normal problem they run into with daily activities of life. Some of these kids would struggle because that's what FASD impacts with them. They have brain damage that they never asked for, they never wanted. But these were pretty amazing individuals. So I couldn't get mad at them when they messed up. I might get a little disappointed, but my job was to help pick them up and say, okay, how can we redirect? How can we get your brain to think about these immediate consequences before you take an action? And, you know, that really impacted me. And when we passed this resolution, SCR 13, in 2014, we heard some pretty personal and amazing stories. I think out of the 60 legislators, every single person had an individual story about somebody they knew that had FASD or how this impacted them. We started some really hard and difficult conversations. So it wasn't just about, okay, we know these are individuals that have FASD in our state. We don't want that to continue. We need to do better than being the worst in this statistic. So how do we prevent this disease? What can we do to help these women who may be struggling with substance abuse that have no intention of impacting their babies? So these are really difficult discussions, and I really thank the committee for having some of those discussions. I know this is not an easy topic, and I appreciate that you're willing to have multiple hearings on this to really flesh out your concerns. And I hope we can just move forward on a path that will help prevent some of these children with having lifelong disabilities.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions, if I could, please. The studies that I had looked at previously were from the Institute of Circumpolar Health, and I did see that there are several studies with regard to fetal alcohol syndrome and prevention of fetal alcohol syndrome. I believe the case studies came from 2003-2004, and it seems like there's been multiple studies since then. Have we looked at some of the past studies to see how successful they were, and if so, are we recreating the wheel? Are we doing something that's already been done with regard to studies of prenatal health? And
so through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, this is not an area that this piece has not specifically been studied. Dr. Amanda Slonway discussed that on Tuesday, mm-hmm. where, yes, we've looked at LARC and how LARC is effective in preventing pregnancy, but it's really about that access to that and what are those access barriers for these women with substance abuse disorders and how do we, you know, connect those women with LARC if that's what they choose to do, because this study would be 100% voluntary. I would actually probably have several other people in the room right now who are some of our FASD passionate experts, but they are actually sitting in Vancouver at a summit. It's like the 8th annual summit on FASD research. There you have Dr. Ken Jones, who actually named FASD, that went up and was talking to some of our folks from Alaska, and they were really excited about this legislation. They were excited about some of the other things we've done. The university, since we introduced this legislation, had an email from somebody in Texas saying, hey, how does the FASD community feel about this study? Because Texas may be interested in doing something like this. So Alaska is actually on the forefront of looking at some of these studies and how we're impacting this.
Okay, and follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Right, and just in that same vein, again, we've had studies on fetal alcohol syndrome and prevention of I'm just trying to get to the core of that information to show if they've been able to pull any information from that and to move forward to try to help prevent alcoholism before, you know, gestational time for a new mom. But the other part of it, too, is, you know, you've talked about the Alaska Regional Hospital being the hospital of choice to help with this study. Is it the desire of Senator Kelly then to just work through the Alaska Regional Hospital and then only obtain information from patients within that parameter, or will they be going out to the very, you know, other rural areas to obtain information? Because it's real important that you do a wide range of gathering that information as opposed to one hospital.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, you're absolutely correct, and that question came up in the Senate Finance Committee. We were very careful and very specific that we did not name one specific winner in this legislation. So Alaska Regional, that name is not listed specifically in the legislation because we said they should partner with hospitals. Now, Alaska Regional is the first one ready to partner because they have the ongoing NEST program. They have an ongoing relationship with the university. However, as the first part of this, the university will be setting up other partnerships with other hospitals. We really hope that other hospitals in all of Alaska would be interested in participating.
Thank you. And then final question. I have to think what my final question was. Yes, with regard to the last study that Senator Kelly had with regard to the pregnancy tests that were at various bars. Do we have the results of those studies, and can we get a copy of those?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I would be happy to share that. That study was actually published in the Oxford Journal, I believe, in January, so I will follow up with the committee to provide that to members.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Vice Chair Zelkowski.
Thank you. Ms. Carpenter, you talked about other studies that might not have been done related to this particular topic. The CDC actually did a choices program to prevent alcohol-exposed pregnancies that used motivational interviewing to increase a woman's motivation and commitment to change, which included 2 to 4 counseling sessions plus a contraceptive counseling session. And it actually was implemented in various settings from STD clinics, community health centers, family planning clinics, as well as clinics that serve tribal communities. There's extensive information as well as facilitator guides and counselor manuals and client workbooks that have all been developed through the CDC. And so I'm curious to know if the university or if the senator's office in the development of this study has gleaned any best practices from the Centers of Disease Control.
Through the chair, Representative Zelkowski, the university has built on that choices study. They actually used part of that in the pregnancy test dispenser study. I believe they implemented that in St. Louis, is that, I think that's the same one you're talking about. And so that would be baked into the study as well, because they're going to build on some of that information in the other studies that they've already used nationwide, because that does work. And so that would be part of what would be used in conjunction with this specific study.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. So it looks like the CDC was that this particular research was being implemented in Baltimore, Denver, New York City, and Los Angeles, as well as the Oglala Sioux Tribe. And so I'm just wondering if there's already extensive, one of the concerns that came up in the last hearing was that $300,000 of the $500,000, when we look at the fiscal note, is in personnel costs. And so what could be statistically significant results that could come from a study that is largely under-resourced when the CDC has resources that have been in several different types of cities and communities and clinics across the country. I'm trying to understand how that would not be duplicative and unnecessary expense. Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, Representative Zelkowski, on the fiscal note specifically, when you're looking at the personnel costs, that's not covering that entire person's salary. So just because a researcher is charging part of their time to this project, they're also working on other research projects. So keep that in mind just when you're looking at the fiscal note, that you know, it may cover part of the personnel cost, but they're also working on other things, so it's not meant to be covering those positions 100%. And
so just as a quick clarification, so I understand that it's not covering the individual's full expense, but what my concern is that what that leaves is only $200,000 of the intended appropriation of $500,000 for statistically irrelevant analysis of the issue.
For the healthcare.
For that, whether that be healthcare or outreach or planning for pathways or the like.
Through the chair, Representative Zolkowski, it was in conjunction with the university that we completed this fiscal note. So this was the budget that they felt like they could do this study with. So I don't have the specific answers to if that is enough. I wouldn't feel qualified to answer that because I'm not the university. I'm not going to be carrying out the specific legislation. However, I do know that they use other research that they have received before. I believe they would implement other pieces from the CDC because they're not going to reinvent the wheel as they're trying to find these other pieces and remove the access and answer. You know, if we can remove these barriers and create access, will that lower FASD?
It may be that it would be useful to have a follow-up response from the PI and other folks at the university with response to the specific question at hand. We are somewhat handicapped with the fact that this is the week that all of the researchers and folks that are involved in this project are in Vancouver at this study. It's sort of very strange timing that this all worked out, that they're all traveling. But I think we can try to get that information, follow up, and distribute that to the committee. Since we're not moving the bill, we don't have to make any decisions about that today based on without that information. Representative Keto has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carpenter, so kind of in follow-up to Representative Sokoski's question about the fiscal note, I was looking at the fiscal note, and it does identify personal services at about a level of $300,000, which is well over half, two-thirds of the grant. And then identifies $150,000 for services and $55,000 for commodities. There's nothing identified for travel. So it does seem as though a vast majority of the money is going to go to university employees and not as much of the money is going to go to care for the subjects of the study. And that gets to that concern I had about making sure that there's adequate medical support for participants in the study. And I looked through the description of the fiscal note, and there was not anything in there about anything regarding medical oversight. In fact, and then the fiscal note description is very, very vague from with respect to a lot of the fiscal notes that I have seen, but I'm looking at Phase one development, which is establish and convene advisory panels, develop clinical protocols and research procedures, quite a bit of money just to have university professionals sit around, I think, and figure it out. Important, do we have enough money in the study in order to do it right if only so much of the money is going to go to actual study and a lot of it's going to go to personnel? Phase two says implement referral protocols, assemble cohort data collection, network collaboration. Phase three, data analysis and reporting, data analysis, strategy development, outcomes, reporting strategy, recommendations. I see nothing in here that talks about the medical support for the individuals receiving the intervention or the follow-up for those individuals for that intervention and making sure that they have medical support throughout the period of time when they are impacted by that intervention. Can you discuss that making sure that the study participants receive adequate medical care?
Do you feel comfortable answering the question, or should we hold it for the university personnel?
I will take a small stab, and also through the chair, Representative Keto, I will work with the university to get you more detail on the fiscal note. Two pieces. I know that part of this will go to cover a case manager, which is really important when you're working with individuals and making sure they get follow-up care to treatment or other services. Part of the commodities piece is covering the cost of providing the actual contraception to project participants who do not have medical insurance. But I will work with the university and let them answer some of those more specific questions about the budget.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We have one last question from Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, for the record, obviously we've got the fiscal notes in front of us, but what's the total amount of funding from various sources going towards this project, and what are those sources?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the total funding through this fiscal note, as it's imagined right now, would come from the general fund. We have not secured other matching funds. That doesn't mean they couldn't be secured in the future, but right now that is how we would fund it, is through this fiscal note.
I believe the PI said the other day that there was another application in for funding to a federal funding agency.
And follow up?
Follow up.
And so what, talk to us about the consequences of if that other request for funding doesn't come through, how would that impact the project, and also if it does, how would that impact the project?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, with working with the university, their whole budget for this project was the $500,000, so this three-year project. They have been working with the federal government on, or other just big-time national funders on different projects. We chose to go this route because we thought it was really important. I think they would keep trying to get other funding to do this study regardless, but I think they could move forward if they are given this amount through this study.
And clarify one time, so if federal funds come in, how would they be used?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I can't answer that because okay. I don't specifically know what that application would look like.
We'll have to get that answer from the principal investigator, who actually was here testifying the other day. She spent over an hour on the record taking rapid fire. All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Carpenter. And with that, we're going to go ahead and move to some invited testifiers. We're going to start with Bill Trawick, a nurse practitioner with the NEST nurse practitioner with the NEST program. And my apologies if I have mispronounced your name. Can you put yourself on the record?
Yes, my name is William Trawick. I am a advanced nurse practitioner with a board certification in neonatology. I'm employed by Alaska Neonatology Associates, a subsidiary of MEDNAX. I am the author of the NEST program, which is at Alaska Regional Hospital here in Anchorage.
All right. Can you tell us about the NEST program, the population you serve, and how that how the NEST program will be partnering on this research project?
So the NEST program is a program that is designed specifically to care for substance-exposed children, infants. This encompasses both their immediate medical care and their detoxification and controlled medical withdrawal from specifically opiate drugs. It also involves the care of the families of these babies and efforts to enroll them into substance recovery efforts or maintain their enrollment in substance recovery programs, and all of the social adventures that entails. We see a diverse population of Alaskan residents. However, I would say on average, well, speaking generalities, our population is approximately 99% state Medicaid enrollees. That would be about the most generalized example of the clientele we serve. They're both people who are what you would refer to as a street-level substance user to persons who are in medication-assisted drug therapy, to persons who are victims of chronic pain syndromes and associated abnormalities who require treatment with opiates and thus have children who are opiate exposed. It is a diverse population of both illicit and illicit substance using persons.
Sure. Vice Chair Zlokowski.
Mr. Trawick, thank you for joining us today. Can you repeat, you were talking about the population that you serve, and I'm sorry I missed a couple of those statements. Can you just repeat them for the record?
It's a very diverse population, and it's hard to draw any specifics from it. We see generally persons who are receiving their health care through Medicaid. That's probably the most consistent finding of any of our families. They're patients who are both using illicit medications on the street, heroin, even illegally gotten Subutex, buprenorphine, drugs that are traditionally used in substance recovery programs, but are often traded illegally on the streets as well. So we see parents who are doing the illegal drugs and also who are enrolled and in good compliance with medication-assisted therapies for drug treatment themselves. A frequent patient type we would get is a mother who is enrolled in one of the methadone programs, and they would deliver at Alaska Regional Hospital, and thus their baby would become a part of our program. And when a baby becomes a part of our program, the family becomes a part of our program. That is one of the defining characteristics of the NEST program, is it is a family-centered, family-intensive program where the family is a part of the care of the baby on a daily basis. It's an important distinction.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that clarification. During our hearing on Tuesday, it was made mention that the NEST program sees a majority of the cases of births with neonatal exposure to alcohol or drugs. And I was hoping you could clarify one question that was asked is if there are cases that are referred statewide to your program. So are there other hospitals or clinics around the state that are referring some of these cases to your facility, and if so, where are those referrals coming from?
Yes, predominantly our patients are from the Anchorage area. However, we do get a fair number of referrals from outside areas. There is one difficulty in doing that, that without the handicap of our geography, I believe we would have many more patients, but it is expensive and difficult to medically transport a baby from an outside community to here in Anchorage. Frequently, we will go to the valley and pick up babies from Matsu Regional, for example. And as long as they are on the road system, we can do a ground transport that's within the capabilities of the NEST program. However, we do not have access to air transport for these babies. And related to the politics of the hospital business, infants that do require air transport usually become patients of Providence, Alaska Medical Center. And although our medical practice, my employer, does provide medical care there, they don't have the services of the NEST program, which, of course, in my opinion, are extremely valuable in this regard. We will receive patients from the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson Hospital, although there's very few that come that way. We have received patients from Alaska Native Medical Center. Although, again, this is unusual as well. They tend to care for their own families within their own system. A family can come to us if they simply request that, but that doesn't happen that often.
Yeah. All right. We have two questions from other members of the committee. Representative Kito.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Trawick. So can you describe for me the resources that the NEST program has to medically treat or medically oversee the actions related to this study in regard to the mothers of these children?
Well, Again, as I went back, that the defining characteristic of the program is the fact that it is so family-focused. And although you'll pardon me if this seems very warm and fuzzy, the primary issue in taking care of these families is developing a culture within the unit itself, within the physical surroundings, and that's carried forth by all of the staff that take care of these families. And it's a culture of respect and an absence of shame. Because our goal is to treat babies who are suffering from withdrawal, but also to maintain infants in the care of their biologic family whenever that is possible. And it is an extremely difficult environment to maintain. So the NEST program has spent great resources and continues to do so to cultivate and maintain this relationship within the walls of the unit on babies who are experiencing an opiate withdrawal that is unable to be managed by what we call non-pharmacologic measures, common sense measures, holding, being soothing, and just measures like that to decrease stimulation and what have you. When a baby can no longer be managed effectively with that, they actually move inside the four walls of the NEST unit, and they're able to take advantage of medically assisted therapies such as opiate replacement therapy. And that's where we would provide these children with minute doses of morphine, which is our typical first-line drug. We administer that generally about every 3 hours, and it is a very time-intensive process. It is one which requires very high levels of nursing care, which is a major expense for the program. But babies in our unit generally have one-to-one nursing care, meaning one baby, one nurse. That is extremely rare in the hospital environment, except for the absolute sickest patients. But it is a fundamental requirement of caring for babies who are suffering from a fulminant opiate withdrawal. So not only do these babies get that kind of aggressive caregiver attention, they're getting medication-assisted therapy, and they're having their biologic families brought in and maintaining a relationship in a caring capacity with these babies. And it's really a remarkable thing. It's not possible always, as the addiction is a horrible process, and it's simply too much to ask of some of our families that they can maintain that kind of open and intensive relationship with their baby. And again, that just makes it more more important for the nursing staff to be able to take care of that baby. But our goal is to have that family taking care of their baby under our guidance and under our medical treatment.
Mr. Trawick, I think you might have misunderstood my question. I do appreciate the work that you do on behalf of the children in the unit. This study is actually proposing that a medical intervention be proposed for the mothers. And what I'm trying to find out, we were told that by the university that the medical support would be provided by the NEST program. I'm trying to find out what resources the NEST program has to provide medical oversight and treatment of these mothers that will be receiving this intervention in order to make sure that they are not adversely affected health-wise as a result of this contraception intervention.
I apologize. One part of our program that is so very important to this is that every mother who comes to Alaska Regional Hospital to deliver undergoes a screening process. And it's a process called the 4Ps Plus, and it is a very widely validated tool which is used to assess a mother's risk of alcohol use and exposure, also of any other substance exposure. As an aside, it's a program that through our efforts And with the State of Alaska Department of Health and Human Services, we have partnered with hospitals across the state to do this same program. But what this four-piece plus does is it allows us to know when a woman is at risk for having these exposures. And so we are very well positioned to identify mothers who may be candidates for this long-acting reversible contraception. And again, I go back to maintaining that culture of respect and an absence of shame, because that is so important in identifying these mothers, cultivating a relationship where you can get to the point where you can actually help these women decide whether long-acting reversible contraception is appropriate for them. As you know, this whole entire program is voluntary. And in order for them to make a sound voluntary decision, they need to have a relationship where they can learn and information can be presented to them. That is a point that cannot be understated, and it would be very easy to do so, but it is vital. There is so much stigma associated with substance use, alcohol use in pregnancy, that it doesn't take much to lose a mother to, and again, I'll use the same word, to shame. And when a mother feels that way, she just isn't capable of making these kind of decisions and even accepting this information. So again, the NEST program, not only do we see a significant percentage of substance using mothers, we are very well positioned to establish a relationship to help them make these decisions.
Another follow-up. I'm sorry, I think you're still misunderstanding what I'm trying to get at. And I think one of the things I'm worried about is we were told in testimony on Tuesday that a lot of these women do not have regular health care, which means they don't have access to a health care provider. But we're recommending an invasive medical procedure to help them in the future. I want to know that there's going to be medical oversight for the women that are receiving these long-acting reversible contraceptives, and I don't know that there are any medical doctors treating or caring for any of these women in the NEST program. That's what I'm trying to find out. Mm-hmm. I still have not heard an answer to that. I've heard a lot of great things that you guys are doing, but I want to know if this money goes into this program and that these women receive this contraceptive, that they're going to have a medical provider, because we were told many of them don't.
Well, you are correct. The vast majority of them do not have medical providers. And it is a very intrinsic part of our process to care for these women even after they leave us. And part of that is to get them into what you would intensively call a conventional medical relationship. So we do not discharge families from our program without follow-up providers. Unfortunately, there's a small pool of obstetrical providers who show a real interest in taking care of these mothers, but there are some, and it is just a normal part of our process to establish relationships between the mother and her provider. Obviously, the mechanics of deciding how this part is going to be administered
I'm sorry, you keep talking around my question, and I guess, do you have medical doctors in the program that provide care for the mothers?
Not in the NEST program. It is a neonatal program.
That was the question, and I thought that was the answer, but that was the question through all this testimony that I've been trying to get to. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I couldn't pick that up.
All right. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Sir, thank you for your testimony today. And just curious, as you evaluate the program that we have before us, do you think as presently constituted it is going to accomplish meaningfully contribute to the developing of that culture of respect and absence of shame you're talking about, or are there some fine-tuning still needed to accomplish that?
Oh, I absolutely think there will be some fine-tuning. It's it's a very sensitive, obviously it's a very sensitive issue, and it could be misinterpreted. The last thing I would ever want one of my families to think is that I'm trying to have them sterilized. That's a horrible, horrible thought to even have, but I can see how some persons may come up with that. So, yes, absolutely, lots of fine-tuning in the operational implementation of this program and in how these measures would be undertaken. But, again, we are very sensitive to this.
Mr. Trawick, this is Chair Sponholz. You know, one of the things you described early on as an integral part of the NEST program was connecting parents with addiction treatment. How do you do that? Can you describe that for us?
We maintain relationships with the provider network within our communities. And some very close relationships. And so we have a social worker who works just for us, a licensed clinical social worker, and she is very effective on capitalizing on that relationship, which I keep talking about, and helping families make the decisions that are more helpful for them. So it is a business of personal relationships and helping people make choices.
Are there barriers to getting people into treatment? One of the things that we've heard a lot about in this committee over the last several months is the barriers to getting people into treatment, whether or not there's enough access to addiction treatment in Alaska.
Absolutely. There's no end to the amount of barriers, both involved in just the depth of a person's addiction. Some people are unable to even accept that they have an issue. But there's some promising developments in that regard. Alaska Regional Hospital, as you may be aware, is in the process of developing a behavioral health program. They've already been through the process for approval for that, and that is well under, or the planning for that is well underway, and that will include detoxification beds as well as substance treatment. But these families, they have so many reasons to avoid these decisions, and it is our focus to help them see around these obstructions, see around what they visualize as threats. To help them accomplish that, we just instituted a new peer support program, which the stories that these women have are horrific and yet they're fascinating. And to have mothers communicating as mother to mother, I think it's going to turn out to be a very powerful tool into encouraging mothers to proceed in treatment.
Thank you, Mr. Trawick. I think that there's a lot of evidence to support using the peer-to-peer model. I want to go back up to the issue of access to care, though. Have you run into instances in the NEST program where you're not able to get people into treatment, or have you been able to successfully find treatment for parents that are ready to find recovery when they need it?
When we do have issues, it would almost... Predominantly, the reason is the availability of beds. There are very few programs around the state that will allow a mother to be enrolled in their inpatient program and maintain custody of their child. That's a huge problem. These mothers, they want to maintain the connection with their baby. They need to do that, and yet it's just not possible for almost, I would say the majority of these mothers are not able to get into the treatment of choice mm-hmm. by the time they are discharged from our program. We have to take alternative means, i.e. the methadone program, which is perfectly adequate, but it is not an inpatient program. So there is a paucity of available beds, and that's our biggest handicap.
Okay. Okay, thank you. The one other question I had was that really, it's my understanding that your program is really primarily designed for families with infants born addicted to opiates, and that this research program is really designed to be focusing in on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. How is it that you're going to identify patients, and what are you going to have to do differently to be able to operationalize that?
You're correct that in the NEST itself, these babies don't present with the medical issues of withdrawal or what have you that requires intensive medical therapy. However, through our extensive use of the assessment program, like in the 4-PEAS-PLUS program, it is very well validated for alcohol usage issues. It is, and I have to say, I can't be 100% sure for this, but the reason it was first developed was for alcohol use. The physician who designed it, that is his specialty. And so I think our efforts of screening, which include short interventions and access to further therapies by, again, our social work system, connecting moms to treatment options, it's going to be the most valuable tool for this very thing.
All right. Thank you.
And all mothers delivering at Alaska Regional undergo this screening. So
okay.
It is a universally applied program.
All right. So you'll be identifying mothers with babies with alcohol exposure at Alaska Regional and referring into the NEST program that way.
That is correct.
All right. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Trawick? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. Next, we're going to move to Marilyn Pierce-Bulger with the Alaska Center for Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Services. Can you introduce yourself?
Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Sure. This is Marilyn Pierce-Bulger. I'm a nurse midwife and nurse practitioner and owner of FIS Diagnostic Services in Anchorage. I am speaking to you today from Vancouver at the FASD conference. So first, I'd like to just say that FASD, I'm also representing the Alaska Center for FASD, which is a new nonprofit in Alaska. FASDs, as has been previously noted, are estimated to impact 1 in 20 children. What I will also say, however, is that it's been quite a contrast to the number of children with autism, which is 1 in 68, and ADHD, which is 1 in 110. So this disability is much more common and prevalent than previously thought. We don't have good prevalence data for Alaska, and that's a discussion for a different day. Individuals who have FASDs and who don't receive a diagnosis, the therapies or supports that they do need, are at increased risk for self-medicating with alcohol and substances. The lower 48 data indicates that 80% of women who are using substances are also using alcohol, which kind of goes back to what your conversation with Mr. Trawick a few minutes ago. The Alaskan children and adults with undiagnosed FASD are impacting our health, education, social service, and criminal justice systems. But most importantly, FASD is impacting their daily lives and their life trajectory. This is a lifelong disability, and the individuals who have it know they are different from a young age. They don't know why, and they think of themselves as stupid and bad because they don't compare favorably to their peers. This is an incredibly isolating disability and can contribute to chronic pain and immune response conditions, anxiety, depression, and the substance use behaviors we are trying to prevent. Women who are using substances are doing so for a reason. This may often be related to multi-generational and familial or other traumas, adverse childhood experiences. And as both a women's and children's health professional, I compassionately recognize the sensitivity around this topic and the role played historically by the government and others who colonized Alaska and tried to impose their version of reality much to the detriment of our indigenous communities. But FASDs and substance use are an equal opportunity disability. And according to the Centers for Disease Control, the women who are drinking in pregnancy in 2018 are white, working, college-educated women who are finding memes and internet studies to support their use that their low to moderate dosing of alcohol may have no impact on their children. What they don't understand is that most of these studies are flawed and don't reflect or don't evaluate the most common functional domains of impact that are revealed over time. Alcohol, since it is both a structural and functional teratogen, which means it has the power to kill and alter cells in the fetus, has more impact than many of the other substances in abuse, and certainly more impact long-term. I have increasing numbers of birth mothers who are now bringing their children free for diagnostic FASD evaluations. They are sharing their stories. These women were often just living their lives and discovered they were pregnant after they were inadvertently exposed to fetus to whatever they might be using. Most of the women that I've interacted with during my career are able to stop, but there may be impact already present. And today, women are more likely to be drinking in a high dose or binge pattern, which is a higher dose over a shorter period of time. For women, a binge is defined as 4 drinks or more. And in Alaska, we have average binges of 7 to 8 drinks, which are double that. These women may be drinking during the pregnancy due to not having information about that. We have providers who are telling them a little is okay. Partners may be encouraging alcohol use, and we do have women with addictions, of course. We know that pregnancy is a reachable moment when women want to envision their new future lives. In my experience, many women who are using substances want something different for themselves and their babies. Helping them to explore their options for long-acting birth control and substance abuse treatment can give them more choice and control over their lives. I don't see SB 198 as a bill that will harm vulnerable women. I see it as a possible strategy to help them help themselves as they move forward toward their personal vision for a more stable and fulfilling future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Pierce-Belger. We have a question from Vice Chair Zelkowski.
Thank you for your testimony today. I'm curious, we've had a lot of discussion about this particular bill, particularly around the reduction of the prevalence of FAE or FASD as well as neonatal exposure to illicit substances, which is something that we, in my mind, could all come to an agreement on. What we've also kind of agreed on as we've gone through this discussion is the need to provide greater support and wraparound services for Alaskans who are seeking substance abuse treatment, which also includes comprehensive contraceptive options for women. But what's concerning about the bill in particular is that it seeks to treat one part of Alaska's population of women differently from others in the context of the goal for improving child health is well-intentioned, but this particular approach as it stands before us stigmatizes one group of Alaska women, and the implication, even if it's not intended, is that women with substance use disorders should categorically be prevented from having children. So I am trying to reconcile how providing what we know is effective birth control to a population of women who may be having children that are seen as a cost cost challenge to the state of Alaska, how there's not a fine line that's being tread. I mean, it seems like dangerous territory. So I guess I'm just trying to understand to hear from you, we understand the benefits of needing to prevent this from children, but can you talk about how this particular bill in its current fashion is protecting the women that are really struggling and not maligning them?
I think as Mr. Trawick identified earlier, the professionals who are working in the field with women who are substance abusing are incredibly sensitive to all of what you just mentioned. In my experience, And I wrote a letter, testimony, which most of you also should have received. I have had years and years of experience working with women who were really living on the edge. And their reality is, if they're not safe and have a roof over their head and know where food's coming for them and their children, they're not paying attention to anything else. At the same time, these same women are trying to achieve some level of control over their lives. What I found when I was working with that program I was discussing from many years ago was these women wanted to have effective birth control. A percentage of them couldn't access it for a variety of reasons, some of whom had FASDs themselves and did not have the executive function to follow through on the steps that are required to do that. So I think that if this bill were able to make effective, highly effective contraceptive choices more easily available to women who are the vulnerable women in our communities, and you brought up the point about stigma, I think that stigma gets in the way for virtually all conversations we have around substance use and FASDs. And knowing how common both of those events are in the lives of people in Alaska and the rest of the world, frankly, I think we need to take a step back and start thinking about these are common occurrences and common conditions. They're human conditions. And we need to really work on destigmatizing that by normalizing certain responses in our healthcare system so that it's just a matter of fact. One of the things I'm involved with a national effort at the Center for Disease Control is helping health professionals have more comfort level around having a conversation with individuals around how they use alcohol. And one of the ways to do that is to just make that be part of a routine conversation every time we see them. And if we start doing that and we start offering these things as routine conversations and benefits, And with a clear mind and a great sensitivity for the women who may be particularly vulnerable, I think that that is a win-win for both mothers and children.
All right. Are there any other questions for Ms. Pierce-Bulger? All right, seeing that, I just want to take a moment to acknowledge and thank you for your work in this area, Ms. Pierce-Bulger. This is your work is really setting the pace, I think, for work nationwide in trying to improve documentation and support for people who experience FAE or on the fetal alcohol spectrum. The community awareness of the prevalence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is really not very aware, and I am often shocked at the lack of awareness in the community of what it is and what it is that we need to be doing to provide supports for the adults in our lives that have to live for the rest of their lives and cope and understand. I shared the other day that my own daughter's diagnosis was sort of like a light going off. It was an epiphany. It was a moment when all of a sudden a lot of things were made sense to me that hadn't made sense, and she's able to be really successful, and you've been at the forefront of that work nationwide. And I thank you for taking time away from the conference today to testify.
Well, thank you. I was happy to do it.
All right. And next up, we have Dr. Robert Bachman with the University of Alaska Anchorage. He is chair of the Institutional Review Board, which evaluates research protocol. Dr. Bachman, can you put yourself on the record and then describe the function of the Institutional Review Board and how this study might go through the what kinds of things the Institutional Review Board might be looking at with regard to the use of human subjects in this study?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dr. Robert Bachman. I'm a professor of psychology, and I am the chair of the Institutional Review Board, sometimes commonly known as the Ethics Committee, here at University of Alaska Anchorage. Thank you for the opportunity to address your committee today. I've been invited by Madam Chair to testify about the role that the IRB plays in ensuring the respectful and ethical treatment of research participants. I have listened to the recording of the proceedings of your committee from Tuesday of this week, and there was one thing I wanted to say at the outset here. I was listening, and I heard Representative Kelly say that the legislature had the capacity to authorize the conduct of the LARC study at UAA Center for Addiction Studies, and that is categorically false. The authorization to conduct the study has to go through the IRB, and ultimately it's my decision to authorize the conduct of a study involving human subjects. The legislature, of course, can authorize the funding of such a study, but the authorization for the conduct of study with human subjects lies with the IRB. So I'd like to provide just a brief overview of the IRB, noting the historical context first, and then go into what the IRB is in terms of its membership and the constitution of that membership, and then go into what the IRB does in terms of reviewing research protocols and what it is authorized to do in terms of, empowered to do with regards to reactions to those research protocols. I also failed to mention that my colleague, Dr. George Kamaroff, who's the Associate Vice Provost for Research and Graduate Studies, is here with me. So I need to mention that. I'm sorry for omitting that. So research with human subjects has a fairly long history and a complicated and controversial history, of course. Concerns about research ethics were really not an integral part of research until the Nuremberg trials, which exposed some horrible atrocities that the Nazi doctors had imposed upon their quote-unquote research participants that history. But a little more closer to home, of course, and I think many of you may know, we had the Tuskegee syphilis studies that were conducted from 1932 to 1972, and the great injustices that were imposed by the U.S. Public Health Service led to the formal adoption of rules and regulations that now guide and ensure that research conduct with human subjects is ethical and fully respectful to the research participants. What we have that guides the IRB, both the formation of the IRB and the conduct of the IRB, is the federal rules that are commonly known as the Common Rule. Also, shorthand for us IRB people is 45 CFR 46, which is pertains to a huge, complex set of documents that guide our evaluation of research protocols. So part of 45 CFR 46 is what an IRB needs to be comprised of. The minimum membership is 5 members, and that UAA's membership has 11 members, by the way. The regulations also stipulate that the membership include a member with scientific expertise, a member with non-scientific expertise. We have a philosopher for that particular role. And we also have the need for a member who is not affiliated with the university. This is commonly referred to as a community representative. Their role on the IRB is to bring to that discussion the perspective of the community's values and concerns and needs that may not be well represented by the university faculty that tend to staff the IRB. It's also the case that under certain circumstances, the IRB is directed to have additional types of representation. For example, if We are reviewing a protocol that includes prisoners. For example, we need to have a prisoner's representative. If we are looking at a study that is focused primarily on Alaska Native people, we need an Alaska Native or Indigenous representative to be part of our discussion. And finally, and relevant to our discussion today, if we are reviewing a research protocol that involves medical interventions, we need to have a medical doctor as part of our discussion, and they provide the medical expertise to help us assess risk, help us assess procedures that might involve medical intervention. The membership of the UAAIRB is on our website, and you can review that, and just notably for our purposes today, we have an assistant professor from the School of Nursing and an associate professor of health sciences on our board. They are not medical doctors, but they have extensive medical training. And in those instances, when we review medical protocols, I will bring in a medical doctor to help us with those decision-making processes. So we meet regularly, and our meeting schedule is post this open public meeting. And during those meetings, actually prior to a meeting, everyone on the board carefully reviews the protocol and prepares notes and comments. And then during the course of the meeting, we deliberate about the concerns that we have about the research protocol. We ask questions of the researchers who are present and, you know, clarify issues that are of concern, particularly as they articulate with criteria for approval as the federal government requires. And the IRB has the power to disapprove studies that are inconsistent with those federal guidelines, that have, you know, excessive risk or disrespectful treatment or whatever it might be. We have a frequently employed power to require modifications. We can look at a protocol and see that although it doesn't currently meet ethical standards, if it, you know, made several significant changes, it could be approved. And so our, probably our most common feedback to researchers is to provide a list of detailed procedural and material changes that are required for further evaluation and possible eventual approval. We also have the capacity to stop previously approved research activities if we learn through a participant calling us or a community member calling us or the researchers themselves contacting us that there's an unanticipated event, we will, you know, bring the research to a halt and ensure that, that it doesn't go forward until that risk has been addressed. The main thing I want to stress here is that no human research activity is allowed to be conducted at UAA or through UAA's researchers unless it has been rigorously reviewed by the IRB. And so one of the things I'd want to highlight now is what are the criteria that the IRB looks at when they're reviewing a protocol? What are the kinds of things that the federal government requires us to assess in our decision-making? There are seven criteria, and I'll expand on one of those in particular, and I'll kind of speak to them as we go as well. So the first criteria is to assess risk to participants and to ensure that risks are minimized. If at all possible, risks are minimized to the point that, that participants really are in little to no danger. The second is to assess the extent to which the risks that are present are reasonable in relation to the benefits that the study may reasonably be expected to achieve. So in the study that is in the Senate Bill 198, for example, there are obviously some risks involved in contraceptive use, but the possible benefits are part of what I've been hearing you guys all discuss today, so those two things have to be weighed against one another. The third criteria is that the research participants, the selection of the research participants is equitable. The essentially what this means is that the burden, the benefit of the research activity, the risk that people are exposed to and the potential benefits that that group of people may receive are equitable. They're distributed across a wide segment of society if possible. What we don't want is for one group of people to be disproportionately burdened with the risks of research and then the benefits of that research accrue to another group of individuals. This criteria also focuses the IOB on vulnerable populations. We look very carefully at studies that look at children, that look at pregnant women, that look at prisoners, look at people who have limited cognitive capacity, mental disabilities. We also look at, we consider people to be vulnerable if they have economic or educational disadvantages. So it's very much in our thinking when we're looking at how a research study samples their participants. The fourth criteria is one that I'll expand upon here in a moment, and that's informed consent. That seems very relevant to what we're talking about today. The federal government requires that research has informed consent processes for each participant and that there are specific requirements for that informed consent documentation. And on the note of documentation, all research studies should have their informed consent processes documented so that the the IRB can verify that. When appropriate, the research plan should also make adequate provisions for monitoring the security of data because sometimes those data can expose the participants to additional risks. So there's got to be protocols in place to ensure the security. And the seventh criteria is also related to data security, but it speaks to issues of privacy. There are certain things that might be stigmatizing in the data, and the privacy is important in that consideration. So I'm going to pause right there for a moment and just ask, I'll make one further note, and then I'll be moving into the requirements for informed consent. That further note is that if and when we approve a study, that's not the last we see of that study. We don't say, fine, go do your research. We say we need a progress report in a minimum of 12 months, but if it's a high-risk study, we can ask for a progress report in 3 months or at any point that we feel that it's necessary to ensure the safety and well-being of the participants. So that's one thing that occurs after approval is ongoing or continuing review. The other is that if the researcher are going to modify their research protocol in any way, they have to get back to us and describe what their planned modification is, and then we review that planned modification and decide whether or not it will be permissible. So I'm going to move into requirements for informed consent, but before I do, I'll pause and ask if anyone has questions about the criteria for approval that I've laid out so far.
All right, we have a few questions from you. Representative Keto is first.
Thank you, Mr. Bachman. So one of the questions I have is in regard to the IRB's experience with studies that involve medical intervention. Can you let me know, on average, say, how many requests for research that involves medical interventions does the IRB review in a year?
Thank you for your question. Through the chair, Representative Keto, the IRB, well, it depends, I guess, on what you define as a medical intervention. If people are taking a blood pressure or a venous puncture, you know, a blood draw, that could be considered a medical intervention. But if we're speaking about things that are as invasive as inserting an IUD, which I understand is probably one of the techniques that would be used in the LARC study, we don't see those types of medical intervention studies very frequently at all. In fact, as I said earlier, we do have a couple of individuals on our membership, on our IRB, that do have medical expertise, but when we do see something like a few years back, we had a researcher looking at high altitude sickness, and he had a certain medical intervention for preventing that, and it was a drug administration up at, you know, very high altitude on Denali. And for that type of protocol review, I invited the doctor onto the board to assist us with assessment of risk. So not being a medical school, we do have the nursing school, of course, but not having a program that instructs people and ultimately ends up being awarding an MD, we don't see a lot of medical research. We do have the WAMI program, but those faculty tend to do their research in collaboration with researchers at other institutions. So the short answer to your question is that we probably only see one or two per year. And when they're really talking about serious medical interventions, such as the one that might be in front of us with the LARC study, that's really quite infrequent.
Just one follow-up. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair. So one just follow-up question on that with regard to that medical intervention. So one of the things I am concerned about is follow-up care. So there's the initial application of the intervention, but my concern is if these individuals then leave the study and something happens post-study, then I guess would the IRB recommend that the intervention be terminated before completion of the study, or would the IRB recommend a protocol for follow-up care so every individual that has received the intervention could receive support for removal post-study or something like that? I'm just looking for the assurance that these individuals will continue to have support while they're in the study, but then also if they still have the intervention post-study.
Yes, thank you for your question. Through the chair, Representative Tito, the response is that we would require some sort of procedure or plan for the follow-up with those individuals who had the LARC intervention. We would require some sort of plan that would specify in detail how those women at a later point in time would have the IUD removed. That would include specifying the time frame in which that could occur, and also, you know, specifying, you know, how that would be funded. What by what means would the mark be removed?
Thank you.
All right. Next up, we have Representative Johnston.
Actually, I have mine answered. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First thing, when you were going through the seven criteria, I missed number five. You did informed consent, and then I was writing down monitor security data as number, or pardon me, informed consent is number four, and then monitor security data is number six. I missed number five.
Five is simply an extension of four, which is that the informed consent will be documented. They have to keep records that they have consented each individual in their study.
Thank you. And I guess my question, there's been a lot of discussion in this study just wanting to understand, you know, how the actual process would work and wanting to be very clear, and this is so helpful. Thank you for all the steps that you put in place, that there wouldn't be any coercion or otherwise push for a woman to, you know, participate or to choose to participate in this study because, you know, we just don't want to have any coercive elements to it as a matter of autonomy for her and her decisions about her reproductive health. And so I guess I wonder, how would you approach, and the place where I'm sort of troubled is the process that was described the other day was, and I apologize because I had to step out and miss the NEST part, and I hope this wasn't already discussed, but the process was described, a woman comes in and has the baby, and then, you know, through that experience, learn that, you know, the baby's born with either neonatal absence syndrome or no, there was fetal alcohol exposure. You know, one piece of that process is that that baby might immediately be taken by OCS, and then, you know, that sort of part of the infant care. And then this woman might be a good candidate for this study. And so the next step would be, you know, then I guess a conversation with her about potentially participating. And I know there's going to be a caseworker involved, and so that gives me some comfort as well. But I'm just thinking at that particular time, depending on how close it is to the delivery, and I say this as someone who's never delivered a child, I just know from my women friends that it's a big experience. But so, you know, she's gone through this pretty significant experience of having delivered a baby, and then because of her addiction, she's possibly in some stage of withdrawal or having, you know, health complications related to that. And depending on the severity of the addiction, her brain is impacted by that. And so from my perspective, you know, that is a woman who's in a pretty vulnerable state, you know, post-delivery, in withdrawal, impact, you know, with impacts to her brain and thinking. And if she's someone who herself had FASD, you know, there could be underlying challenges as well. How do we ensure, how will you, when you're helping them put together the plan here, ensure that, you know, that particular, you know, period of time where it sounds like the conversations about participation might take place would be done in a way that was really whole person-centered? And my understanding is the case manager aspect of this is because, of course, one intervention is addressing pregnancy prevention, but then there are other things, addressing mental health issues, addressing the substance abuse and addiction, those type of things. And hopefully that's where the case manager comes in. But I guess the way I envision it is almost like that person needs an advocate, or, you know, what we do with children, for example, with a guardian ad litem or something. It's almost like that person needs somebody who kind of keeps them from, you know, getting sort of directed or guided into a choice, and just, you know, is fully aware of their ability to make the decision at that time and can kind of be an advocate for that.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, was it?
Tarr.
I'm sorry, Hart?
Tarr.
Oh, Carr. I'm sorry. Thank you for your question. I think that this is actually a good segue for me to speak about the informed consent requirements and the informed consent process. And it's also an opportunity for me to note that what the IRB does, of course, is review a very specific operationalized procedure and set of materials, a very specific plan. And as I understand it, such a plan does not exist at this point. I mean, I know that the PI, the principal investigator, Amanda Sloan White, was speaking to you on Tuesday about kind of like what the likely features would be, but we don't really have a specific plan to respond to at this point. However, back to the sort of general requirements, which we would apply to any study, and this will address your question as well, let me just run through them. There are 7 requirements, and then I'll specifically roll back to your concerns about, you know, how do we ensure that a woman who's in this state is capable of providing consent. So the federal government requires that there's an informed consent process, and the 7 elements of informed consent are, first, that the study is adequately described. It explains that it is research. It explains what the likely experiences are that will be encountered. It explains how long the study will be going on. It is meant to identify any particular aspects of the procedure that are experimental in nature. A second aspect that's required is a description of any foreseeable risks or discomforts that may be encountered through the process. A third part is to describe any benefits that the subject may receive directly to themselves or benefits that may be extended through the study to society. And although I'm taking this a little bit out of order, this is the eighth requirement, but it's very important to your question. This is a statement that the participation is voluntary and that refusal to participate will involve no penalty or loss of benefits to which the participant is otherwise entitled. So this is really, this is in every single consent form, so that a vulnerable person, here's a woman who, you know, is vulnerable. She's just gone through this traumatic experience. She's reliant on the hospital for providing care. And we say, hey, do you want to participate in this? And she might be thinking, geez, you know, if I don't, that I they might kick me out of here, or, you know, I might, you know, babies might be taken by OCS or whatever. It's incumbent that every consent form have that language that says that, you know, if you choose not to participate, it's not going to affect you in any adverse way. And similarly, that same statement has to include language that says that they can discontinue participation at any time or change their mind at any time. So if they say, yeah, but then half an hour later when their brain clears up a little bit, they decide they don't want to be in there, that is something that is in front of them. So that's the eighth requirement. I'm going to hop back to four here. They have to disclose any alternative procedures or courses of treatment that may be available and advantageous to the subject, so we can't dangle this carrot. Like, here's this great treatment, there's nothing really else. The fifth requirement is that they have to describe the extent to which any confidentiality of records or identifying information, how that will be held, how it will be maintained, how, you know, any breaches of confidentiality that are possible. The sixth requirement is that if the research involves more than minimal risk, there has to be an explanation as to whether any medical treatments are available if injury occurs. This speaks to a concern we were speaking about earlier. You know, if there's something, there's a complication or a problem with removing the LARC later, how will that be addressed? And finally, the seventh one, and we've already spoken about eight, is an explanation about who to contact if they have a concern about their research participation, a question about the research. Basically, if they have any issues or any concerns about their rights, there has to be contact information on the consent form about who they can be in touch with that will answer their questions or advocate for them. So those are the required elements of informed consent, and there are also some special requirements that have to do with vulnerable population. Children, for example, cannot consent. They have to have an assent process and parents consent for them. At our IRB, we see a lot of research that involves adults with diminished intellectual capacity, and there's always these very long and robust discussions about how you treat these people with dignity while at the same time ensuring that, you know, we're not asking someone who isn't capable of providing full consent because they don't quite understand. So it's very important that research is conducted with these people to provide improved services for them. But at the same time, consenting those types of individuals is not the same as consenting adults that have full intellectual capacity. And so any situation where a person is stressed or under duress, or may have limited capacity to understand because of their intoxication or something like that, we always have to consider those kinds of caveats and conditions on the consent process and institute procedures that might involve other individuals like advocates or guardians if necessary, or just make sure that the person is in a place mentally where they can adequately address the decision of whether to participate or not.
Follow?
Thank you. That's very, very helpful. And where I'm coming from is I represent the poorest district in Anchorage and the most diverse neighborhood in the United States. And so among different populations of people, there's, you know, varying levels of trust for people who,
right,
who are seen in positions of authority. And so I guess my concern is I just wouldn't want a person to, because of, you know, cultural differences or lack of understanding of our medical system, to feel, you know, like they didn't have the ability to make their own choice in that situation, and they might respond, you know, to a person coming with like a questionnaire and forms and things like that. Like that could be a scary experience, where they might feel like they're getting in trouble for something, and so there just may be some hesitation on the part of that individual to participate. And these are, you know, historical incidences. I mean, you're talking about the Tuskegee experiments is, I think, a reason why if you're a person of African-American heritage, you know, you might approach this with a different feeling, for example, than someone else, because it may be, you know, from your own lived experience and your own family's experience that you know of these bad things having happened before. And so for me, it's just really, really critical that I can feel that there are enough safeguards in place that wouldn't happen. And important that you've talked about the alternatives because, again, and I cannot claim in any way to be an expert, but just someone who's trying to learn, you know, as much as I can all the time. But among the different populations in the area that I represent, reproductive health care is viewed in many different ways, and use of birth control is viewed, you know, it's not a universally positive thing, I guess is how I would describe it. And so this could be a very new experience for one of these women. And so I just want to sort of make sure that there's enough safeguards in place that they're not pushed towards it, and enough protections that they're, if they need an advocate or someone to otherwise, you know, help them negotiate that decision, that would be in place.
Yes, thank you. The issue of coercion is very, very important on the IRB. Just to kind of underscore that for you and the other members of the committee, for example, in a prison, people have very little access to resources that we take for granted out in the free and liberated world. And so whenever we are looking at a proposal that involves research participants who are prisoners, we look very, very carefully at incentives. If someone is offering $10 for participating in an hour-long survey or interview, our IRB might look at that very, very carefully, because $10 in prison could be a monstrous sum of money that would be highly coercive. So we often have these very long discussions about minor amounts of money or even gifts, such as, you know, a stationary pad or something like that. The whole point is the sensitivity to how influential or coercive even a minor incentive might be for a prisoner. We look at the issue of choice and the issue of coercion and how that differs by population group quite a lot.
All right, we have a question.
And the power differential between the researcher and the research participant is also something we examine.
Mm. We have a question from Representative Keto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Brockman. I appreciate the discussion on informed consent and coercion, and one of the things that you talked around for me and I want to make sure is clear on the record. I would not want any of these mothers to have any expectation that if they participated in the study with the LARC, or that if they agreed to any other contraceptive method, that might have an impact on whether or not they would receive their child back if their child is in OCS custody. Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine that if I was in that situation and my child was taken away, that I wouldn't think if I followed the government's recommendations that they might give me my child back. And so I do want you to comment on that, because I think that's something that in this situation, because there's not just individual voluntary participants, there are children that may or may not be custodians of the parents, that is a grave concern for me.
I, through the chair, Representative Keto, thank you for your question. It's a very good one. As I said, we're very, in our discussions and deliberations on the IRB, we're very sensitive to the whole context in which the research is occurring, We recognize that different groups of people have different needs and perceptions and concerns. Some of those things vary by culture. Some of them vary by educational status or occupational status, or in this case, we're talking about drug users versus non-drug users or the stigma that might be associated with that. Although criteria 8 that I mentioned states the refusal to participate will involve no penalty or loss of benefits, that really may be a stretch for a woman in this position to think, well, I know I'm not going to lose a benefit, but will I gain an advantage by participating? You know, might I get earn my baby back if I participate? I can't say for certain, but I would suggest that that's a likely conversation that the IRB would have, and we may get around to requiring language in the consent form that would indicate that, you know, the hospital's treatment of the baby will not differ as a function of participation. But I do appreciate what you're suggesting, is that they may feel like they have to be good patients in order to receive benefits from the hospital staff.
And I'd just say there are nuances in here that could be very complicating, but I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Indeed.
All right. Thank you. Does that conclude your testimony today, Dr. Bodman? It looks like Representative Carr has another question. My apologies.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just didn't want to take too much time if other folks had questions. We had received a letter, and so I just want to bring this to your attention that just with respect to the IRB board, this woman said she had worked with you in the past and said, however, in the past, although unintentional, IRB has approved studies that have harmed vulnerable populations, and although they have learned from these missteps and taken steps to prevent these oversights from happening again, we must remember they are not infallible. And so I just wanted to share that with you, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot to comment or anything like that, but I think that's sort of, in my mind, you know, that's sort of the genesis of this, is that we're all human and so likely to make mistakes, and we do all the time. And so that's, you know, sort of really trying to tease out every little detail is just to kind of get at that. And I just want to make sure it wouldn't be unusual, but we have some amendments for this bill, and they get at a couple of the points that you talked about, because we were concerned about the follow-up care and removal if there are any, you know, contraindications for use. And so we have an amendment related to that, and then also in that same amendment, just specific language that says, you know, that the LARC, if it's determined that the LARC is the most appropriate contraceptive, then it's used, but that it needs to be a comprehensive conversation that, you know, gets to that place. So I hope that'll give a little bit of direction, and if you see that, you'll understand based on this conversation that that those were the ways that we wanted to, you know, address the concern, even though we know in the process you haven't really developed the protocols yet and you don't have the advisory council together. But the other thing I wanted to just double check, when I came in here, you were talking about the membership and that the board must have representation from the group of people who were participating in the study. And I apologize because I had just come in as you were talking about that. So, for example, in this case, are you saying that there, you know, someone or ones involved in the development of the protocols would be perhaps a person who's in recovery or a parent of an FASD child or, you know, someone who I would hope that you would have, you know, minority representation from women of different backgrounds. Do you have anything you can sort of add to just help me understand that part of it?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I've heard several questions there, and so I want to try to tease them out and address them independently. First of all, you mentioned a letter by someone who had claimed to work with me on the IRB. And I think I may appreciate what you're referring to here. I have a letter regarding from Serene Rose O'Hara Jolly. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be the letter you're referring to because the content I can see has some of the things that you raised. First of all, I should mention that although she refers to an IRB, it's not clear which IRB she's referring to, and it might have been the one in Fairbanks, but I don't recall at any time that this person worked with the IRB here. It certainly is true that IRBs have made mistakes in the past. I'm certain that that has occurred, and I certainly do my best to ensure that we don't make mistakes on our IRB. And we've had virtually no complaints. We process in the neighborhood of 600 protocols a year and encounter very few problems. So I don't know what she's referring to. Maybe it's kind of the bigger picture where, you know, in the context of research in the United States, there has been some problems from time to time. I certainly wouldn't deny that that occurs. The other question I heard was regarding the necessity for having representation on the IRB membership. It is the case that we have to have a scientific member and a non-scientific member and a community representative, which is meant to kind of capture a lot of things that are outside of the academy, outside of the university, that are more relevant to the community of Anchorage. We have two community representatives. One of them is Marla Greenstein. She is a lawyer, a practicing lawyer here in town, and I think she works as an advocate for certain disadvantaged groups. The other is David Tarsi. He's a community member. He tends to work, he's a researcher, not affiliated with the university. He does social science research to assist underserved educational groups in the state of Alaska. And, of course, you know, the faculty, the federal government might recognize the faculty as weird beasts, but we also have children in the school district, and we live here in the community. Anyway, so we don't necessarily require a certain ethnic representation. We're supposed to have as much as possible a balance of men and women and have avoid having an all-white IRB. And we do have some diversity on the IRB, both in terms of gender and ethnicity. But if there is no specific requirement beyond prisoners to have a representative, prisoners and Alaska Natives. We it sounded like you were saying that we were developing the protocol, but that's the researchers who do that, and then they bring that protocol to us to evaluate in terms of the ethical guidelines. Have I missed any of your questions?
No, that helps, and pardon me for not being clear in terms of your evaluation of the protocols. I think it would be very, very important to have women and women of color to be a part of that, because it would allow the process to bring in some of that lived experience that I think is the reason there's heightened concern and sensitivity, you know, about just the way the study is going to be designed and who it's sort of geared towards. So is that something
right
that you can, you know, you've got your existing IRB board, but can you otherwise invite other people to participate, to provide feedback? Or would that be more appropriate for the advisory council who will work to actually develop the protocols, you know, make sure that that is a very diverse group of people, you know, to have good representation there?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, thank you for that further question and elaboration. That part of our evaluation would be looking at the protocol and the extent to which it is inclusive and respectful of the communities that it's going to be assessing, so that community, the advisory board that you mentioned, would be something that we'd look very closely at. In terms of the actual IRB membership, I'd point out that we have Dr. Angela Trujillo, who's an Hispanic woman, and she has a doctorate of nursing practice and a Master of Women's Health nurse practitioner and advanced community health nursing in her qualifications. So two masters and a doctorate, and two of those masters are focused on, both of the masters are focused on women and community health. So certainly she could speak, I think, authoritatively to some of those issues. This group of people, I've been working with them for, you know, more than a decade, and they take the community's concerns very seriously.
All right. Thank you. So for Representative Tarr's information, too, I just want to be clear that we're setting aside this bill today. At this point in time, we're going to go to about 5:10 so we can try to get as much of the public testimony as possible before we adjourn for the day. We're going to come back to this again on Monday. We're going to have a special meeting time on Monday, so stay tuned. We'll work with committee members to try to find a time that works for everybody. And with that, I want to go to Jeannie Gerhardt-Cyrus from Kiana.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jean Gerhardt-Cyrus. I am a parent of multiple children with prenatal exposure. I also serve on the Governor's Council for Disabilities and Special Education. And through that role, I chair the work group on FASD, one of them being the prevention work group, which has addressed this issue. Speaking as a parent and also someone who didn't necessarily have control over reproduction, I appreciate the discussion about safeguarding people's rights. I think it's critical. I have children, and I certainly would want their rights to be safeguarded. And we certainly are not looking to take away anyone's rights, but to empower women to be able to plan pregnancies when they are ready and to enable them to give birth to healthy children by virtue of having access to LARC. And the statistics you have about the increase in neonatal abstinence syndrome and the percentage of women, percentage of pregnancies in Alaska which are unplanned. Granted, that does not mean unwanted, but it does mean unplanned and unprepared for in terms of establishing a healthy environment for the baby, both within and without. And also the high rate of women with opioid use disorder who have unplanned pregnancies. FASD is a very personal issue to me. Both my family and many, many families that I've worked with and assisted over a long, long time. And the risk of these children who are born exposed being involved in custody, state custody, and also the trials and tribulations that they experience in the school system, in the correctional system, in treatment, all as a result of 100% preventable issue. And this means just giving women, empowering women, again, to give birth to healthy children when they are ready. And I also want to say we're not looking to prevent these children from being born. We just want to ensure and increase the odds that they will be born healthy and not have to have issues to overcome, which can be prevented if women do have access and choose it to preventative, to birth control that's long-term and is reversible. So I really appreciate the discussion because, as I said, having children myself, I know about FASD, and I know that a lot of parents or would-be parents who themselves have been exposed and more than likely have not had access to the supports and accommodation they've needed to live successfully and are therefore, as somebody mentioned, self-medicating by turning to substances. I've witnessed it firsthand with my own children. And those women, empowering those women to make a choice to say, I'm not ready. When I'm ready, I want to be able to bring healthy children into the world. I know that impulsivity is a big issue with FASD, and so having a long-term reversible contraceptive increases the odds of prevention of children who would be exposed. I think I can't speak enough to giving children, babies, and families the opportunity to raise healthy newborns and children who start out at an advantage because they're not having to overcome from the get-go the issues that are caused by exposure. So I would like to encourage you to allow the study and, again, empower women to have healthy children free from exposure when they are ready and choose to do so. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions? Oh, all right. Representative Char has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for your testimony and sharing your personal story. And I thought two things you said were really important about, you said something at the beginning about a someone who really hadn't had choice. And I think that's really a big part of what our conversation is about today is really making sure that women, like you say, are empowered and have choice. And then also you said something about, you know, not that these children are unwanted or something, and I just thought that was really important, perspective on this and the value. So thank you.
All right, and just
to the chair, thank you very much. I feel extremely strong about that. And my children, and if they could have gone through and not had to deal with a lot of the issues, it certainly would have made a huge difference in all of our lives. Not a want.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And as we wrap up our last 9 minutes here, I just want to make a couple of comments. We have a few people. We have a lot of people on the line to testify. We're not going to get through everybody. I apologize. I'm trying to take people that have been on the line for the longest, and we have one guest in the room who I know doesn't live in Juneau but is here in the present, and I want to give her an opportunity to testify in person. So I'm going to try to move through probably three people on the phone and then one person in the room, and then we're going to have to call it a day at 5:10 because there's several of us in this room that need to be somewhere else at that time. So I apologize to everybody that has been on the line wanting to testify. This is a really important and intense and complicated issue that I think deserves the additional time that we're going to give it. We will set a time for an additional hearing on Monday. We'll post that time as quickly as it's been determined. We just need to check everybody's availability because we'll be working outside of the traditional HESS committee schedule. So, all right, with that, we're going to go to Ellen Hodges, who's in Bethel. Ms. Hodges, are you there?
Oh, hi. Yes, sorry. There was a disconnect quickly. Yes, I am here.
All right. Go ahead. Introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Ellen Hodges. I'm a physician in a rural Alaska site that primarily serves Alaska Native people. I'm testifying on my own behalf, and I'm testifying to raise and voice my concern about Senate Bill 198. We've had other testimony about the children who are affected by drugs and alcohol, and I'd like to voice concern about the women who will be affected by this bill. My practice
takes care of a lot of women and children. I do a lot of reproductive health in the area where I practice. I'm concerned that this bill will take us back to the shameful days when forced sterilization and contraceptive coercion was a common occurrence in vulnerable populations, including the Alaska Native and American Indian population that I work with. And by the way, this is not in the dark ages, in the 1990s, nor plant, a long-acting reversible contraceptive implant, which has been removed from the market, was required of some women to obtain certain benefits and to avoid incarceration. No one wants children born exposed to drugs and alcohol in utero, but we already have available to us as medical professionals randomized controlled trials that establish best practice to reduce alcohol use in women who engage in risky drinking behavior. The Center for Disease Control details such program in CHOICES, but there are many other such evidence-based programs which have been validated across the nation in many populations. Furthermore, there has already been established by the American Academy of Pediatrics the best treatment for neonatal abstinence syndrome, and there exist many multidisciplinary teams across the state to diagnose and treat fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and to follow up with these families. This money could be better spent on programs such as CHOICES from the CDC, which are already researched and validated, or on drug and alcohol treatment programs that are so desperately needed in rural areas such as where I practice. Furthermore, I have concerns about the study design and follow-up of these women who have long-acting reversible contraceptive placed. This type of contraception cannot be removed by the woman herself. She requires an appointment with a healthcare provider for removal. Some of this remains in place or can remain in place for up to 10 years. How will they be followed? Who pays for the removal? What if they leave the state of Alaska? Who handles complications, for example, an exploratory laparotomy for a woman who has a migrated IUD? Women in substance abuse programs have the opportunity to make positive changes in their life, and this is a very good time to do this. But we already have the knowledge that comprehensive wraparound care with motivational interviewing and comprehensive contraceptive counseling is proven to reduce risky drinking behavior, and as a result, children born to these women who are affected by fetal alcohol syndrome. This bill does not describe enough details about the study design, and testimony that I heard today from the NEST program or the IRB from UAA did not alleviate my considerable concern that these women will either explicitly or implicitly be coerced into using long-acting reversible contraception, taking us back to the days of forced sterilization when it was allowed and encouraged. We know already that access to birth control counseling and motivational interviewing reduces risky drinking behavior among women who have children and women who don't. And we have the studies to prove it. I just simply don't think this study is necessary, and it puts our state at risk of going down in history along with those shameful programs that allowed this type of coercion that is a dark stain upon the medical area where I practice. Thank you. That's the end of my testimony.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Next, we're going to go to Genevieve Mina in Anchorage.
Hi, my name is Genevieve Mina. I live in District 19. I'm a UAA student representing myself, and I'm testifying in support of SB 198. As a woman who has a LARC, I know that my IUD is over 99% effective, and it's far cheaper and convenient than other forms of birth control. But I come from a privileged background that includes comprehensive sexual education from my high school, not having to worry about taking time out of my day to get the IUD procedure, and knowing which providers are covered under my own health insurance. So the conventional care that occurs right now works for me, but it isn't working for certain women who do have substance use issues, who statistically have higher rates of unplanned pregnancies. So I believe that this issue of addressing women's health for women with substance use disorders is far more complex and nuanced than just offering, you know, more access to contraceptive care. We need to rethink what access means. Access is about surpassing financial, institutional, and social barriers. On financial barriers, just because you can access a service for free doesn't necessarily mean you have the incentive to get that service. For example, I would be pleasantly surprised if everyone in this committee who's covered for a flu shot has actually gotten that flu shot, even though you're covered for it. On institutional barriers, many women may want a LARC, but cannot find a provider that has LARC available at their facility, or the features of the conventional methods of care that we have in our healthcare system may not work and be accessible for them. And finally, on social barriers, many women have misconceptions about LARC because they have not received proper sexual education on that, like I have, or if they are a user of opioids like heroin, they often have a huge distrust and fear of the healthcare system where they avoid providers altogether. I believe that within the bill text in SB 198, particularly under Section 1, Subpoint 2, Subpoint 3, and Subpoint 8, supports a research project that aims at better strategies for women's health. Additionally, concerns about coercion will be acknowledged under the review of the IRB, as we heard earlier today, which does provide room in the study for education and the autonomy for women to choose whether or not they want to go LARC, to undergo LARC as a form of birth control. Substance use during pregnancy is a complicated, sensitive issue, and it does require a nuanced approach and research to improve public health for the most vulnerable in our population, including women and children. Please pass SB 198. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much. And it turns out we don't have somebody in the room. The person I thought was in the room that wanted to testify does not. We're going to take one more testifier, and we're going to close out for the day. We're going to go to Bess Odom in Anchorage. Or Bessie?
Hello. For the record, my name is Bessie Odom. I am here representing myself, and would like to say thank you to the chair for the opportunity to testify today. I would like to start off by saying that this bill's intent is honestly apparent and means well. However, I'm asking you all not to support this bill in its current form. I believe that this bill does not get to the base of the problem of the particular group of women we are seeking to help. In my honest opinion, I believe we should be putting more money and resources into programs to help women who are in need. I would rather see money allocated to bettering already existing programs and organizations who aid women battling substance use disorder. What this bill insinuates is that a woman who has substance abuse disorder should have her right to have children to be controlled, not by herself, but by those who they don't know and may not even trust. What I genuinely believe is that we are ignoring the fact that if there's good educational programs and accessibility to programs, that these women can turn their life and their situations around for the better. As a woman, and particularly an African-American woman, this bill is highly insulting to me. This bill reminds me of the history women in my community have been telling me for years, women like my grandmother. It was said that women like my grandmother had a choice whether they had a hysterectomy or not. However, many women living around the time of my grandmother were uneducated and lacked the resources they needed to make a truly informed decision about their reproductive rights and their bodies. Back in history, groups of particular women were targeted and sought out because their offspring that they could be producing would be less desirable to the population. These women were forced to endure hysterectomies involuntarily. These women were forced to be subjects of experimentation. And these women were forced to take contraceptives they had no idea about. This bill is a great reminder that we should be educating ourselves about the history of reproductive rights in marginalized communities. Time after time have marginalized women, either that be substance abuse disorder or women of color, have always been victims of violated reproductive rights, and this bill in its current form may indeed open the door to rights of women who are extremely vulnerable to be violated. This bill is also insulting because it insinuates that a woman who is battling substance abuse disorder is a woman fully not capable of having children and turning her own life around with the right support. We are insinuating that this marginalized group of women are no more worthy than any other woman in the state to have children. I know that FASD is a huge issue in the state, as I myself have three siblings who battle the disorder on a daily basis. But I'm encouraging you all to please read your history books and inform yourselves on reproductive coercion, and I'm encouraging you all to be sympathetic to a group of women who are truly in need of not contraceptives, but are in need of true support systems and great educational programs that work and address the issues of them as women. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, we are going to call this hearing, meeting closed for the day. We're going to leave public testimony up and pick it up again on Monday morning. Thank you.